Good morning. You're listening to Midpoint on WMNF Tampa, and I'm your host, Shelley Reback. As we've been doing during the Florida legislative session, we're reviewing the new legislation passed during this, the most dangerous time of the year for Floridians. Today, let's start the show like Rachel Maddow does by putting our topic into a historical context. At the end of the 19th century, America was awash in a wave of new immigrants, most of them working for low wages and often terrible working conditions. Some of them worked at the McCormick Reaper Works in Chicago, where they produced the McCormick Reaper, a machine that combined all of the steps of harvesting crops in one so farmers could save time and increase the size of their crops to feed America's growing population. In 1884, Cyrus McCormick Jr. announced that he was cutting his workers' pay in order to decrease corporate expenses. This was the year his company made a 71% profit. His workers unionized. They joined together to demand better pay and an 8-hour day. Then they went on strike, and McCormick was forced to reinstate their old pay scale. But the next year, McCormick installed expensive machinery designed to eliminate the most troublesome workers. The machines broke down. They cost more than his workers had. McCormick didn't care. He thought he had broken the union, but the union wasn't finished. Again, they demanded higher pay and better working conditions. This time, McCormick closed the plant and shut out the unionists. He bribed the Chicago mayor and the Chicago police. He hired scabs, non-union workers, but he was so desperate for workers that he agreed to let the scabs work an 8-hour day, which was what the union strike was all about in the first place. The strikers were furious, and the police were in the pocket of the plant's owner. Tensions were high. On May 3rd, 1886, 137 years ago today, several workers at the Chicago McCormick Reaper Works were killed by the police during their strike for better working conditions. A demonstration was called for the next day in Haymarket Square to protest the killings. On May 4th, about 2,000 people showed up to that protest. August Spies, a German immigrant anarchist and labor leader, opened the rally by climbing atop a hay wagon and giving a speech on the, quote, good, honest, law-abiding, church-going citizens, close quote, who had been attacked at the McCormick factory. He was followed by Albert Parsons, a former Confederate soldier turned anarchist. Chicago Mayor Carter Harrison was even in attendance at the rally to ensure the protest was peaceful. But toward the end of the rally, 180 policemen arrived to disperse the crowd, and someone, still unidentified to this day, threw a bomb at them. The police and possibly some members of the crowd opened fire, chaos ensued, and the violence led to the death of at least 8 people. The nation was outraged. Mostly at the strikers, because people had been conditioned by the media, then newspapers and weeklies, to view the workers as foreigners who were attacking America's laws and customs and were grooming workers to be socialists and anarchists. So despite a lack of any evidence against them, 8 labor activists, including August Spies, were convicted of crimes in connection with that bombing after a sensational trial and a controversial verdict in which the jury was known to be biased and no solid evidence was presented linking the defendants to the bombing. 4 of them, including August Spies, were hanged in 1887. The Haymarket affair was a setback for the organized labor movement in America, which was fighting for workers' rights, like the 8-hour workday that began the strike at the McCormick Reaper factory. At the same time, many in the labor movement viewed the convicted men as martyrs. So in 1889, May 1st was designated International Workers' Day, otherwise known as May Day, a day in support of workers in commemoration of the Haymarket affair. Today it is celebrated by 60 countries all over the world, but not in the United States. In the United States today, immigrants are still the villains. But according to Fox News and the Republican-controlled legislature, so are public school teachers, who, just like the union organizers of the late 19th century, have also been accused of indoctrinating students with socialism. That's why, a week ago, the Florida Republicans passed a bill aimed at weakening organized labor's clout. This bill is directly aimed at kneecapping teachers' unions and other public employee labor groups who tend to support the Democratic Party. And in a clear indication of that bill's political intentions, the Florida Republicans added a carve-out to the union-busting bill that the anti-labor measures would not apply to any unions who represented cops, firefighters, or corrections officers. Those unions are more likely to support Republican candidates and policies. Also, 4 days ago, the Florida House passed a bill that would have prohibited living wage ordinances. That's when the local governments require companies with government contracts to pay employees above the state's minimum wage, which currently sits at $11 an hour. But the Florida Senate saved low-wage workers by keeping in the section that applied only to minor league baseball players, but losing the section that applied to other municipal living wage ordinances. So on the cusp of International Workers Day, we're going to talk about these possible changes to the labor laws in Florida with my two guests today. I have Cheryl Schroeder with us. Cheryl is the executive director of the West Central Labor Council in Tampa. So welcome, Cheryl. Happy to have you.
Thank you. Thank you for being here, yes.
And attorney Ryan Barrick is here with us. Ryan is an employee rights lawyer based in Clearwater at Qual, Barrick, and Nadeau. Happy to have you here too, Ryan.
Thank you, Shelley. Happy to be here.
And you, out in the WMNF listening land, are also welcome to join our conversation on these issues today by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting us at 813-433-0885. Let me start with you, Cheryl. First of all, is DeSantis likely to sign these bills into law whenever he gets back from his taxpayer-funded junket to the Middle East and London?
If you're referring to the dues deduction bill, we're fully expecting that he will be prepared to sign that when he comes back. We kind of feel that it was a goal of his during this legislative session to basically try to undermine public sector unions.
So. Yeah, let's talk about what's in that bill, that dues reduction bill. As I understand it, the bill has a provision that says that unlike in the past, where dues were deducted automatically from public employees' paychecks and paid to the union to establish their union membership. Now, they've gotten rid of that automatic deduction provision, and public employees are going to have to go out into the world and join the union themselves through other means, right?
Yeah, effective July 1st, that's supposed to pull the plug on employers deducting union dues. They're still going to be able to deduct other things such as charitable contributions, contributions into their 401ks or any other benefits plans that they choose. It's strictly limited to union dues to the public sector union. And so it is a sea change. The teachers union in the state of Florida is the largest union that represents employees. And consequently, it's going to be a really big task to touch all these members and ensure that they have an avenue to pay their union dues. And so there's many efforts underway right now. E-dues, I've heard it called, but electronic payment of union dues. I mean, really the internet and the ability to pay things on your computer or through your credit card.
Or your phone,
exactly. That's going to facilitate the transition from no payroll deduction to the other forms of payment, whatever they may be.
Well, let's talk about why it's important or why it was significant enough for the Florida legislature to ban automatic deduction payroll deductions to join the union. Let's talk about why that's important. Isn't it because in order to have a union be certified to bargain on behalf of its members, the union has to actually represent a certain percentage of people in that industry, right?
Certainly. When the union is formed, it has to be a majority. So it's just a simple 50% plus one majority to create the union. But, of course, many of these unions have been long established. So, you know, our membership fluctuates. This is a right-to-work state. There's a lot of people that are in that enjoy the benefits of a collective bargaining agreement who choose not to join for whatever reasons they may choose. So, you know, the membership fluctuates in an individual union drastically from, you know, one month to the next. So I think the impetus of this bill is to basically cut off the funding, the ability of these unions to, one, represent their members, and two, to propagate and to move an agenda that makes their work easier, better, you know, through collect. Teachers are subject to a lot of laws under the state as far as
and more every day.
And more every day.
And in Florida.
Our ability to weigh in and to deal with those types of legislations and bills that are coming down is going to be reduced if they are able to cut off the money.
Yeah, because you're a lobbying organization as well. I mean, I don't mean you personally, although West Central Labor Council
is, right? Oh, absolutely. That's exactly what we do.
You represent union members, right? Well, tell us what West Central Labor Council does.
We're an AFL-CIO affiliate. We represent 12 counties in Florida, so from Citrus County south to Sarasota and as far east as Polk County, basically the Tampa Bay area. And we represent union members of all the different unions, public sector, private sector, and building trades. And our goal is to bring these unions together to speak as one voice in political and legislative actions.
So with regard to this bill that appears to target the teachers union as the largest public employees union in the state of Florida, to me it looks like a union busting bill, because the percentage of union membership determines whether or not the union can be certified to represent the workers. So if you have less members, like you were discussing, then, you know, as a bargaining entity, you know, they don't have the clout that they would otherwise have to, you know, to bargain on behalf of the people that work in that industry. So making it more cumbersome for unions to collect dues that means fewer people might join. And teachers already are treated differently from other unions in other, say, private businesses, because we are a right-to-work state, right?
So correct.
Teachers can't strike. They can't.
They're barred from striking.
Yeah.
Florida
Constitution. Tell us about what it means to be a right-to-work state.
So the right-to-work state simply means that if you're covered by a collective bargaining agreement, you do not have to financially support the organization that covers that bargaining agreement.
So you do not have to join the union that represents you in your industry.
In the state of Florida,
in
that's
the state
correct.
Of Florida.
So already there's a stopgap measure for those who disagree with the union or for whatever other reasons philosophically do not feel that a union is important. The right to work law protects them already. So when you want to call this a union busting tactic, I think that's fair. I think it's definitely an effort to undermine the ability of public sector unions to represent their members. And again, as one of the largest unions, and then when you count the teachers being one of the largest unions in the state, and then when you start counting cities and counties who have municipal workers that are going to be affected by this, the number really becomes, you know, exponentially large. And I always see a collective bargaining agreement in the state of Florida as being an economic engine. When people are paid better, they have more disposable income, they're spending in the communities. You know, if you're making significantly above minimum wage, then you have the ability to buy a house, buy a car, spend, you know, more money on furniture or clothes and things like that. By taking away a union, basically you are shutting down that economic development. And I think that it's kind of short-sighted of the legislature to do this. they excluded what they call special risk employees, which would be police, fire, and correctional officers, but they did not include EMTs. And when the sponsor of the bill was asked, why didn't you include EMTs, and he really didn't have a response for that. So it does feel like it's a target.
Yeah, it feels like they're targeting teachers because the teachers' unions do lobby mostly for Democrats because of the desire to support their employees in the way that you just described. I mean, let's face it, the New York Times this weekend, for example, in an article about Randy Weingarten, who is the president of the American Federation of Teachers, which isn't even the biggest union in of teachers, noted that Mike Pompeo, of course, a Republican, former CIA chief and Secretary of State under then President Trump, called Randy Weingarten, who was the head of that teachers union, the most dangerous person in the world. So, you know, it does really feel like this is a political move on behalf of the Florida legislature to attack a Democratic, you know, strong entity that supports Democratic candidates
and really
policies.
I think it's really been an attempt to silence the voices. Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Ryan, you're a lawyer. Let me throw this out to you and see what you think. But the devil's advocate argument for in favor of these laws like this would be that the marketplace and competition will adequately regulate workers' pay, because businesses, just like old Cyrus McCormick Jr., are competing for workers. And if they don't pay enough and if they don't treat their workers well enough, the workers will just seek other employment. So, you know, that's a reason why not to support unions. I mean, does that really work?
No.
Okay.
that's an easy one. No, I think if you support the idea of a free market and allowing people to compete, then unions are exactly consistent with a free market. It is people coming together and making a decision to work together to raise their own, to raise their wages. That's the definition of capitalism, right? Working to get, you're trying to get more money is a capitalist society. And that's one of the goals of this, of a collective bargaining agreement, is to try and increase wages and benefits. Benefits have a economic value to the people who are getting them, and make their working conditions better so that their jobs are better. The thing that's is really clear here, and one of the things that's so important to remember is these are called dues checkoffs. And what we're talking about here is where people, and it was literally, it used to be that you would check off saying, I want my dues deducted. And they're treating unions different than they're treating other employee deductions, right? You're being able to say, yes, I want to put money towards my health savings account. I want to put money towards retirement. I want to put money towards a charitable contribution that you can make as a as a deduction from your wages. There are all kinds of deductions that we're allowing people to make from their checks. And what the Florida legislature has said is this one we're going to treat differently and badly, despite the fact that this has been the way it's been done going back for a long, long time in both public and private sector unions. We're not going to allow checkoffs anymore. And it's really treating unions differently with the goal.
Certain unions, though.
Certain unions, like
I said, you know, those who tend to support Democratic policies and candidates differently from those who tend to support Republican candidates and policies.
I mean, there's absolutely a political speech element to this and the basis for these attacks. The goal, and another portion of the law that we haven't discussed, is to try and create a threshold about the number of employees eligible, at which point the union has to be subject to a possible recertification, which means they might have to go through the election process again.
That's what I was referring to earlier, where if you don't get enough members, and of course this new legislation will make it more difficult to get members. So if you don't get enough members, you might need to be recertified.
Right. And again, and that would lead to the expense for the union, but also for the district, of having to conduct another election, right? I mean, this is not free. This is going to end up, and the analysis from the Florida legislature suggested we're talking about almost $1 million of additional costs immediately associated with enacting this law. So if someone is advocating for sort of being fiscally responsible, we're actually taking what is something that costs almost nothing to administer and making it more expensive both for the union but also for the state, because if we have more recertification petitions and more union elections, those are expensive. There is time associated with administering the election. There's time associated with people having to re-vote. I mean, it is a giant mess that accomplishes nothing legitimate. It is simply an attack on employees and their ability to come together to try and advocate for themselves.
All right. Yeah. Well, do you have any questions about these labor laws? If you do, give us a call and let's talk to Cheryl and Ryan about them. Our number here is 813-239-9663. Email is dj@wmnf.org or text us at 813-433-0885. You're listening to WMNF Radio in Tampa, and we have our two labor experts here with us, Cheryl Schroeder from the West Central Labor Council locally, and Ryan Barrick, who's an employee rights attorney in Clearwater. So we'd like to hear from you, too. In fact, Gary says, I hate the term right to work state. Doesn't that really mean that you could be fired for no reason without a real right to work? I don't know.
Without a collective bargaining agreement, yes.
Yeah.
So there's a common misconception between employment at will and right to work, and those are two distinct concepts, and they often get confused by people. All the time, people call my office, and what they're talking about is employment at will, and what they say is right to work. Employment at will means you can be fired at any time for any reason, which is and you have no guarantee of any of continued employment. They could fire you tomorrow, or you could quit tomorrow for any reason.
Unless you actually have an employment contract employee that defines the conditions under which you could be fired for cause, no cause, et cetera.
Exactly. And in that case, you wouldn't be employed at will. You would be employed pursuant to a contract. And sometimes those contracts are collective bargaining agreements. And that would be an example
union
of
union agreements.
Union agreements, right. That is a distinct concept from
Right to work.
Right to work, it means that you can't have what's called a closed union shop, which means you have to be a member of the union if you work at a place that has a union contract in place. And that is, Florida doesn't allow that. Some states do allow that. And that's designed to prevent what are called free riders, right? Which is the person who's getting the benefit of the union contract without actually contributing to the cost of administering the union. And to be honest, I mean, those people are sort of
freeloaders.
And Cheryl might
you
not say
it.
That.
No.
But,
well,
Cheryl probably would
probably
say that.
Not politically correct, but yes.
But I mean, it is a problem. And unfortunately, in Florida, that freeloader problem is enshrined in the Constitution. Mm-hmm. And if I ruled the world, that's one of the many things that I would fix. But I think that it is a fundamental problem with the way labor laws are structured in Florida is that we are, and again, it is not, if you believe in capitalism, it is not a capitalist idea that these people are getting a benefit and they're not contributing at all to the cost of getting that benefit.
Mm-hmm. Right. So. All right. Well, I've got a call from DeAndre in Brandon, who's been patient. You're on the air, DeAndre.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I really appreciate this conversation. This question is kind of out left field. I am a rideshare driver. This has to do with teacher, as a matter of fact, my spouse, my wife. I constantly see that she is lost for time. She has no time, you know, with this, with all her responsibilities. And something that was made evident with COVID and the shutdowns, unfortunately, is the corporations are, you know, going to 4-day schedules or they're doing
right.
More.
Well, what's your question for my guests?
My question is there by chance any appetite to kind of, and especially with politicians on the right regularly lobbying issues with time onto its adversaries, let's call us. Is there any appetite for trying to fight back by giving teachers and staff more time, shortening the days?
Okay, well, let's find out. Let's find out from our union rep. Thank you for calling, DeAndre. Cheryl, do you know whether that's part of what any of the teachers' collective bargaining agreements are going to be addressing?
I know that it's a struggle every year that the collective bargaining agreement is open to give teachers more time for planning, to give teachers more downtime. Obviously, their days are very, very full. Unfortunately, you have some mandates from the legislature that require the number of days that a student is in the classroom. So we'd have to work around that. In addition to the fact that planning time and those types of, quote, free times that teachers have in order to set up instruction and do things for their classroom and their students is definitely on the hit list every cycle when they collectively bargain.
All right. I've got JT on the line who's been patient. JT from Lakeland, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. This is JT, actually. He is in Cat.
Okay.
But anyways, I can relate with DeAndre. Here in Imperial Polk County, Florida, my wife is an educator for 23 years in Polk County School Board. And, man, I could go on and on. She barely made it under the tenure cutoff, which, you know, Republican legislature governor took away from teachers in Florida. She also is constantly working at home. Again, last night and every night this week on the sofa next to me with her laptop, she's doing lesson plans. She's constantly working at home at night and teaching to a test. They are teaching to test requirements because the legislature now they have these test requirements and standards that these kids have to meet, and so they're trying to teach the whole group of them towards a test standard. And many are left behind because they can't keep up.
Okay, all right.
So my question to your guest, I'm sorry, let me get this question out.
Yeah, get it out quickly.
My question to your guest is, what can be done for teachers that are quitting the profession as far as raises that are not only for new teachers but for the tenured of the older teachers?
Okay, I think we get the gist of it, JC. I'm going to have to cut you off. It's been a while, and I certainly understand your frustration, and you've spoken about it, you know, very comprehensively. But I think that one of the issues about this whole attempt to make it more difficult for the union to bargain on behalf of teachers for all of the different kinds of things that JC was talking about, you know, these are ideals and benefits and policies that Democrats support that Republicans don't. They don't want to make it easier for teachers in Florida. They don't care that teachers are leaving the profession, at least public school teachers in Florida. You know, they're happy to have people go to these charter schools, be paid less, be not subject to, you know, the benefits that a union can obtain for them. And, you know, they don't care about supporting public school teachers as far as I can see. What's your response to that, Cheryl?
Shelley, I think that you're seeing a legislature that and a governor that has taken great pains to totally control the atmosphere of our schools. From the time that teachers have to plan to how much they paid to their retirement to every aspect has been addressed, even to the curriculum and what teachers can and cannot say, what books are in the libraries. This is all being very much controlled and audited by the legislature. And I think it's definitely a frustration for our school teachers because many of them love what they're doing. They don't want to leave the profession, as he pointed out, but however they feel that for their own sanity, their own comfort, or just, you know, for whatever reasons they are. You know, U.S. News and World Report just put out a report that says Florida is number one in education right now.
Number one in education.
But with all the woke and the other legislative mandates that are coming down that have yet to be implemented, it will be very interesting to see how quickly Florida falls from that top spot.
Yeah, that must be an old statistic. I don't know about that. So I want to talk for a second about the loss of the section of legislation that applied to living wage ordinances. This was an effort by the Florida House, which is the more radically conservative, you know, part of our legislature compared to the Florida Senate, to try to ban these living wage ordinances that various municipalities, local government entities had passed to try to make sure that private businesses that do work with the municipality, that do work with the county, that get contracts for county work or city work, pay their employees a living wage. And so, you know, some of these ordinances said that the private businesses had to pay more than the current minimum wage in Florida. So, you know, they might require that they pay all of the $15 per hour or $20 per hour or what have you. But I think that it's interesting that the Florida Senate did not adopt that particular position by the Florida House, other than for minor league baseball players, right? So, you know, Ryan, tell me, why do you think that we've seen that divergence between the House and the Senate?
Well, I think if you're someone who supports the idea of local governments being able to act independently and function for what's best for the people in their local community, and maybe there were some people in the Florida Senate who believed that we should allow local governments to do what it is they want to do, that would be a helpful thing. I think that, unfortunately, it's long been the law in Florida that local governments can't establish a minimum wage outside of the context of the entities that they contract with. So since 2003, the local governments haven't been able to enact their own minimum wage for sort of general businesses within the jurisdiction. But what they have been able to do, and what they unfortunately will be able to continue to do, is to say, if you're going to contract with us, you have to pay at this higher wage rate, and we can determine what it is that wage rate is going to be. And that's really an important thing, because those help drive up wages and they help encourage other employers to give good benefits to their employees. So it's beneficial for us that did not pass. It is scary that it almost did, that it did pass the House, and that fortunately the Senate didn't take it up. But it really represented another attempt to limit the power of local governments to make decisions, to have their people, have their local representatives make decisions about what is best for them.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate that, because I think we'll be probably seeing this come back in the next session. Cheryl, you want to weigh on?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that it's not really so much these local municipalities that are establishing new minimum wage. It's a living wage. It's factored. The factors that go into it are cost of living, cost of necessities in the community. And MIT, if you get online and do MIT living wage calculator, there's actually, they go through and take those variables into some type of a computation and come up with what would be a living wage in a particular municipality. And these living wage ordinances are also the basis of many union contracts. So, for example, if in Miami-Dade they have a living wage of $18 an hour, then the union contract reflects that $18 an hour, not the $11 an hour that minimum wage currently is at. So it would have been somewhat another union-busting attempt, in that it would have undermined a lot of those union contracts.
Yeah, I mean, these bills have the backing of powerful business interests, powerful business groups, and they've been previously pushed unsuccessfully. It's been unsuccessful this legislative session, but we can be sure that it's going to come back. In fact, last year, a similar bill was pushed by Power Design, which is a St. Petersburg-based electrical company that paid millions to settle a wage theft case in 2020. They don't want to pay those higher living wages. They want to pay minimum wage.
They're very much a backer of that House bill.
Yeah, and they put a lot of money behind lobbying in favor of that kind of ban on living wages. A day after the House bill and its companion were introduced back in February, the billionaire owner of the Chicago Cubs donated $1 million to Ron DeSantis' campaign. So, you know, we can see, you know, where the interests are.
The money
that's supporting this. You know, it's so interesting to me that, you know, the unions are always... you know, the villain here, you know, because they lobby in favor of policies that are consistent with more along the Democratic policy perspective. And yet, you know, we have these millionaires, billionaires, and hugely profitable business interests that are lobbying, you know, to keep people paid less, with fewer benefits, working longer hours. I mean, it's not so much different from, you know,
the Haymarket days,
right? And we have and we have people being called socialists for wanting a living wage, you know, for wanting, like JC's wife, you know, to have work-life balance as a teacher. I'm going to take a call from Dave, who's been very patient. Dave in Sarasota, you're on the line.
Hi, Shelley. Thanks for taking my call. I have two questions. I don't know how the Florida law affects anything, but you have a right to join a union, but you don't. If you went on strike, you could be replaced. I don't understand that. And the other thing is, your guests know what the PRO Act is. And I'll take my answers off the air. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Dave. Well, we have a labor lawyer right here with us who can answer that question about why workers can't strike.
Well, so there's sort of two issues. Under Florida law, public employees generally can't strike. And so that is a problem, because it takes away a lot of their bargaining power. And it creates a system where you're sort of a captive. And there is a mechanism to try and resolve disputes. But again, unfortunately, it doesn't necessarily play out in a fair way. And that's different than what the caller was asking about. He was asking about whether or not strikers can be replaced. And in fact, the National Labor Relations Board is looking at that issue right now. There is the general counsel from the NLRB has issued some opinions that suggest that the federal level, for non-public sector employees, so for private employees, they're going to look at the ability to replace and the circumstances under which they can replace strikers. And I think there's an opportunity there for employee rights and worker rights to be sort of to be supplemented and to become stronger as a function of limiting the circumstances under which striking workers can be replaced. And hopefully that will pass. And that's something the Biden administration is doing, which goes back to your prior point that there is absolutely a political element to all of this. And the labor laws, to some degree, shift pretty dramatically depending upon the administration of the president at the federal level. They shift. And in reality, in the state level as well, when you have someone like Ron DeSantis and the current makeup of the Florida legislature, they use that as an opportunity to attack those that they think don't support their political agenda. And so they're doing that now. And then when and you would hope that if Democrats are able to regain power, they would restore that balance and come in with some more logical laws.
Okay. I've got a call from Alec in St. Pete. Alec, you're on the air.
All right, thank you. I just have a quick fact check. Ms. Schroeder was correct to say that Florida is number one in higher education per U.S. News report. However, they also issued an article just earlier today that gave DeSantis an F on education reform.
F as in failure?
F as in failure, yes.
What teacher did that? Shelley, if I could I go
thank
back?
Thank you, Alec. Thanks for that fact check. We appreciate you paying close enough attention to make sure that we stay on our toes and provide accurate information. So thanks very much for that. Appreciate it.
Shelley, I just wanted to go back to the earlier caller that asked what the PRO Act was. And the PRO Act is an initiative by the AFL-CIO at the federal level to amend the National Labor Relations Act. It hasn't really been changed since Taft-Hartley, and it stands for Protecting the Right to Organize. So anybody that wants to look that up, that's certainly something that we've been working on behind the scenes to get introduced and passed in Congress.
Yeah, so, you know, what about that? Like, if the National Labor Relations Board passes these different measures, but the Florida Constitution has provisions in it that seem to conflict, you know, how does that work, Ryan?
Well, private sector labor law is generally governed by the National Labor Relations Act. But so that would be private employers, non-government employers. The state employers in the state of Florida are generally governed by the Florida legislature and the Florida Constitution. There's a bit of an overlap when it comes to private employers in Florida and the notion of right to work and how that plays out. And that's a bit of a problem. But generally, private employment is governed by federal law, which is going to be the National Labor Relations Act, which is different than public unions in Florida, which are governed by the Public Employee Relations Act. So you've got all these acronyms. There's NLRB, there's PERA, PERA, there's FLRA, there's all kinds of brief letter acronyms that can become very confusing if you fall into that rabbit hole.
So I guess that means that if you find yourself in a rabbit hole with your employment, best to contact an employment lawyer, right?
Well, or if you're fortunate enough to have a union, go see your shop steward and ask them for help. And that's really the benefit of, you know, having a union there is you don't have to be an expert on those issues because your union has access to people who are expert on those issues. And your union has, shop stewards, and then you go up the chain and there are vice presidents and presidents and lawyers who work for the unions both locally and nationally who are able to bring in that expertise that the employees can access and use when they have those problems that come up at work, which again is a great reason why people should, if there's a union available, they should join it. And if there's not, they should try and create one.
There you go.
All right, Ryan.
All right, there you go. Workers of the world, unite.
Yeah, that's right.
I have Mary on the line from Tampa. Mary, you're on the air. Thanks for calling in.
Sure. Thanks for having me. I was calling in regards to the right to work unions in Hillsborough County. And I heard a lot of what he said, but I don't understand all of what he said. So we know from our union and the classroom teachers in Hillsborough County School District that you're not allowed to strike. That you're not allowed to strike because of the right to work. Is that correct?
No. No. Okay. Who wants to take that?
I'm going to defer to the lawyer.
Okay.
Well, so it is not the Florida Constitution doesn't say you don't have the right to strike. It's Florida statutes that say that you don't have the right to strike. It's the Florida legislature has enacted a law that says, it's called the Public Employee Relations Act, and it's the law that says that public employees don't have the right to strike.
So that means that that's a law that can be, you could get rid of it, you can reform it, you can amend it if you vote and you change the people in the state legislature who pass those kinds of laws, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it is something that if people wanted to, if there were the political will to elect politicians who are going to support workers and support the people, they can fix a lot of these problems, right? And they can say, we're going to allow workers to strike, and we're going to allow people to come together. And really, if we wanted to, we could change the Florida Constitution to address the problems with the right to work. I mean, we change the Constitution with some frequency in this state. It is it's something that we do, and that is something else that we could correct. You know, we put marijuana in the Constitution. We put pregnant pigs in the Constitution. We put the minimum wage in the Constitution, right? I mean, Florida only has a higher minimum wage than the federal minimum wage is $7.25 an hour. The current Florida minimum wage is $11 an hour. That's a function of the voters twice deciding that we wanted to have a higher minimum wage and put that in the Constitution. We originally raised it once back in, I think, 2004, and then much more recently, the voters came together again and decided we want to raise it from taking it all the way up to $15 an hour, and then from $15 an hour in 2026, it will then continue to increase on a annually inflation-adjusted amount so that we don't have to go back every year and try and get the minimum wage.
Amend the Constitution.
Right. And one of the problems that we have with the federal minimum wage, which is only $7.25 an hour, is it doesn't change. Mm-hmm. So it has been set at $7.25 an hour since 2009, and before that it was lower, but it doesn't change, and so everything else gets more expensive, but this minimum wage amount remains the same.
Right, and people can't live off it.
Well, with the right to work, if we could be fired at any time.
No. Right to work is, as Ryan pointed out earlier, first off, it applies to all employees in the state, not just public sector or private sector. What right to work means is that if you have a union in your workplace, you really don't have to support them financially.
Yeah, you have the choice
to
join or not to join.
collective. Yeah, got it. Whereas the right to the inability to strike is only affecting public employees.
Right. Okay,
what
Mary.
I'm sorry. One more question. What if the school district decided, well, they won't honor the union's request for pay increases?
I think
what if they just stopped? What if everybody just said, we're not going to go to school and teach until we have this and this? Like 100,000 employees.
Well,
what if they just said, we're not doing that?
That's a job action that would have to be kind of condoned and work together for everybody to be participatory. Otherwise, it would probably not have a lot of effect. But as far as what the district decides to pay you, the Hillsborough Classroom Teachers Association just settled a impasse and won the impasse, and all teachers in the district are going to be getting the negotiated salary that was negotiated several years prior that the district denied. So if you're in the instructional side of the school board, you should be getting some pay raises. So good luck.
Yeah, that's a credit to the Hillsborough Classroom Teachers Association.
Yes, ma'am.
Union.
A function of a union.
Function of a union. Right. Okay, so we are here on WMNF Tampa on Midpoint with Cheryl Schroeder, who's the Executive Director of the West Central Florida Labor Council, and Ryan Barrick, who's an employee rights attorney in Clearwater. And if you have any questions for them, get them in right now before we get too far into the show where we can't take them anymore. So you can give us a call at 813-239-9663. You can email us at dj@wmnf.org, or you can text us at 813-433-0885. What else should we talk about, Ryan? Can we talk about the minor league baseball players?
I think that's an interesting little topic to mention. So the Florida legislature just recently, the portion of the bill that did pass from both houses and has been sent to the governor's for signature, amends the Florida state law on minimum wages, and essentially what it functionally does is it says minor league baseball players don't need to be paid the minimum wage. And it does that by just removing an effective date and adding the word as amended. But the goal of it really is to impact on minor league baseball players. And the interesting thing is people think, well, baseball players, they make a lot of money. That's true at the highest levels of the major league baseball players, but minor league baseball players actually make very little money, and some of them make very little money. A study suggests, and they make very little money both in the signing bonuses that they get and very little money in their regular salaries. It is this misconception that baseball players make a lot of money. Again, at the highest level, at the major leagues, the big stars make a lot of money. But the average signing bonus of a drafted player, well, let me rephrase that, 40% of the drafted players receive a signing bonus of less than $10,000. So you have a lot of young men who have spent their childhoods and young adulthoods focusing on baseball and spending a lot of time and a lot of energy, and they come out and they think they're going to get this big contract, and all of a sudden they get drafted and they're excited that they get drafted, and then they end up with a contract with a signing bonus of about $10,000 or less, and then they end up earning a very low salary or a low wage payment, and many of them were earning under the minimum wage, and that's really an issue. There was a lawsuit that was filed in California over this issue, and I want to make sure I get these numbers right, but I believe that it was like in excess of $100 million that was paid to minor league players because, again, they were being paid so little and they weren't getting paid minimum wage.
So I have a question here emailed from Jeff, who says, great show today. Could you ask Ryan why the current state government is attempting to pass a bill eliminating any corporate minimum wages above the Florida minimum wage? I think, you know, the simple answer, Jeff, is it's capitalism, right?
Well, it is the Florida legislature seeking to do to prevent local governments from enacting laws that they think help serve the people in their communities better. It's the Florida legislature trying to being in the pocket of big business and trying to control the ability of workers to come together and try and get better wages and better working conditions for themselves.
Yeah, I mean, it's all of a piece with all of their other preemption bills, I think, Jeff. You know, like we can't even have a local tree ordinance. We can't prevent plastic bags from being distributed for free in our local grocery stores. And now there's legislation pending about the local municipalities not permitting phosphate nitrogen fertilizers to be used during the rainy season to protect our environment. They want to get rid of that too. So it's all of a piece of this attempt to preempt any local governments, because let's face it, the cities in Florida, the biggest counties in Florida, they're blue. They're Democratic run. They're Democratic policy generators, and the state legislature is not, and they want to be in control.
Yeah, Shelley, I think that one of the things that people have to first off get politically involved and really watch what their legislators are doing. A county commissioner here in Hillsborough County represents more voters than a House rep.
Right.
To the Florida legislature. So, you know, let's go back to home rule. Let's give it time to, let's give our local municipalities the right to govern. But I just want to say before we end today that this is really firing up the labor movement. We will overcome this. We actually, it's like a kick in the butt for us. And we're really looking forward to meeting the challenges that this legislature has brought on to local labor organizations.
All right. Well, it's another argument, as we have been following the Florida legislature this session, yet another argument to get politically engaged, yet another argument to direct your resources, your attention, your time, your treasure, your money to support those candidates in the state legislature that support the policies that help you live a better life. Because right now, that's where everything is coming from. It's coming from the state legislature. So we've got to pretty much wrap it up now. We're at the end of the show. But I want to thank my guest, Cheryl Schroeder, executive director of the West Central Labor Council in Tampa, and employee rights attorney Ryan Barrick from Clearwater, for being with us to fill us in on these new labor laws and why we should be paying attention to them. If you're interested in the labor history of Tampa in particular and local efforts to fight fascism, come tonight to the book launch of Sarah McNamara's new book, Ybor City, Crucible of the Latina South. Sarah's a friend of the show, and tonight she's going to be officially launching her book and at the Ybor Crest building, that beautiful restored building on 7th in Ybor at 6 p.m. So I want to thank also my WMNF volunteers, Jessica Green, who is my soundboard operator, and Barbara Fling, who answers phones for us on Midpoint. I want to apologize to any guests who've called in who we didn't get to talk to today, and encourage you to stick with Midpoint and call back on another show. Most importantly, I want to thank you, all of you, the lovely people in listener land who tune in to Midpoint and who give me the privilege of punditry and commentary and editorializing every week. If you appreciate the Midpoint show, please feel free to drop us a donation in the tip jar and tell the WMNF powers that be that you listen to Midpoint and you like it. Your support to keep us commercial-free 24/7 is so important, because we are brought to you by you and the WMNF community of generous supporters. Now, please stay tuned for Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa.